You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. What is the most rational or tangible approach to holiday giving? Professor Peter Singer is going to join us later in the hour to discuss the roots and consequences of altruism. Did you do any giving yesterday on Giving Tuesday? We're also continuing to retool some holiday Christmas carols to reflect the digital Christmas experience. The movie Elf, downloading on your Firewire, email alerts of Christmas deals. You know, we're messing around with Christmas carols, and we want your help. Reach out, join the Christmas Lyric Festival of Yuletide Digital Cheer at thetakeaway.org. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. We're getting all kinds of great stuff. Just remember to use the hashtag DigitalXmas. We begin, though, with a discussion of how the U.S. is playing catch-up in Asia this week. Perhaps is the Obama administration caught unprepared for what looks like a major power struggle going on in North Korea? Kim Jong-un ousting powerful former mentors and consolidating power among some younger leaders. The unrest in Thailand continues. Perhaps there's little the U.S. can do here, but Vice President Joe Biden in Tokyo yesterday stepped right into the middle of a dispute between Japan and China in the East China Sea.
We, the United States, are deeply concerned by the attempt to unilaterally change the status quo in the East China Sea. This action has raised regional tensions and increased the risk of accidents and miscalculation.
Vice President Biden is in China today. Is the U.S. playing catch-up in this dispute over the sovereignty of a chain of islands in the East China Sea? Do we have a vital interest here? And if so, how do we defend it? Two voices, the military and diplomatic views on all this. Peter Dutton is professor and director of the China Maritime Studies Institute at the U.S. Naval War College. Peter, welcome.
Thank you.
And joining us is Nancy Soderberg, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So, Peter, let's begin with you. Could we do anything militarily here to either push back on China's claim of sovereignty of the airspace over these islands in any way that wouldn't actually raise the stakes, raise provocation levels?
Well, let me clarify a few parts of your statement there. I think China's declaration of an air defense identification zone, or an AID, is actually not a claim of sovereignty. And in fact, they're Ministry of Defense spokesman came out yesterday and explained that that's not at all what China is trying to do. In fact, an air defense identification zone in general, or an AIDIS, is a pretty normative practice. Many coastal states have them as a sort of sorting out mechanism for national security, potential national security threats from the air. So right off the bat, it's important to recognize that China's AIDIS is not in and of itself problematic. It's more the way they announced it, the way they did it, that I think has become problematic. The real problem, and I think what we hear Vice President Biden saying when he says China has unilaterally changed the status quo in the East China Sea, is that by claiming to have an air defense identification zone, that is to say a right to sort out security threats above the Japanese-controlled islands called the Senkakus in the East China Sea. Well, that's national airspace of Japan. Now, to be clear, China does claim that those islands belong to them, but the Japanese have been in control of those islands since 1895. And so this is, I think, what Vice President Biden was alluding to in terms of the change in status quo.
Okay, Peter Dutton, let me push back a little on that, though. This is really the kind of thing that seems to be creating a scenario where China will confront a Japanese aircraft over those islands. It seems that's what China is bringing on here.
Yeah, indeed. And that's the real problem, I think. And that is that because Japan controls those islands, it's Japan's sovereign airspace above them. For China to declare that it has a right to go into that airspace and to use that airspace for its own national security concerns, this is an affront to Japanese sovereignty. And it's a serious one, I think. And it's also regionally destabilizing. I think this is part of the reason why we see the sort of regional pushback, because China's been pushing across the region for quite some time now against its neighbors where it's got overlapping claims with Vietnam and the Philippines, et cetera. And now Japan is facing the same kind of pressure from China. And this is a challenging and destabilizing regional event, I think.
Peter Dutton, professor and director of the China Maritime Studies Institute at the U.S. Naval War College. Ambassador Nancy Soderberg, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Peter Dutton mentioned that in 1895, the Japanese began claiming sovereignty over these islands. 1895, also the period where Teddy Roosevelt was mediating another conflict in East Asia between Japan and Russia. Is there a role for the U.S. here, and can it have influence in any mediating sense between Japan and China, in your view?
Absolutely. We have treaty obligations that say that we'll defend the Chinese control obligations. And we will be smack in the middle of this if there's any kind of military confrontation. One of the challenges that Vice President Biden has is to sort of begin that dialogue. This is another testing by the Chinese of its power, its effort to expand its role in its own region, which it has the right to do peacefully, largely, I think, to protect its economic roots and things like that. But this is a longstanding commitment that the U.S. has a direct role in trying to make sure it does not escalate. You asked earlier if there's a military solution here. Often what we will do is put warships in the vicinity just to kind of look scary. And I don't think this is anywhere near that zone yet. But if you see that happening, then we're really at risk of escalation. So diplomacy is the port of first call for this fairly significant development.
So let's push this as the kind of sort of diplomatic chess game that it seems to be here. I mean, I see China holding all the cards in the sense that this little dispute could, if the U.S. gets involved here, force the U.S.'s hand on its commitment to Taiwan. Now, that's inviolate. It's absolutely in treaty obligations. Every president has reaffirmed our commitment to defend Taiwan. Yet, in a sense, China is in a position of forcing our hand on that. And if it turns out that we don't really have the will to defend Taiwan, and most Americans probably wouldn't want us to do so, then the Chinese win.
I disagree. I think we do have the will to defend Taiwan and have actually moved carriers in there in response to threats in the 90s that the Chinese did over some of the elections. And I think that you have to remember, we're still the largest military power, the largest economic power. China is growing quickly, but it is still no match for us on any level. I will put my money on the Americans every time on this type of thing. But we don't want to have a military confrontation here. But we hold many, many cards here. Number one
But let me push you on that. 52% of Americans believe that the U.S. should mind its own business internationally. The Pew study and, done along with the Council on Foreign Relations suggests that right now there is no domestic appetite for interventions anywhere in the world. Even the Chinese understand that Americans' appetite for getting involved in something like this is very, very limited. And this tiny dispute with Taiwan there at the other end of the East China Sea is, right in focus.
That study is actually quite interesting. It says that 52% of Americans think that we should mind our own business. And that's a fairly typical, although bigger, spike after an end of a war. We had similar spikes after the Vietnam War, after the Cold War, though this is more dramatic. But what's interesting about that study is majorities actually say that we need to be engaged in the global economy. And they understand the need to expand our trade routes, deal with other countries, and be engaged in the world for global economic issues. What we're tired of is wars. And no one's talking about going to war with China over this. What it will take is very strong diplomacy. That's why the vice president's out there, perhaps some show of force just to say that we mean it. But I have absolutely no doubt that we would defend Taiwan and Japan, regardless of these polls. But I don't think it's going to get to that. This is China testing. We'll push back. And I think there will be eventually some kind of negotiations on this issue. I don't know an analyst that thinks this is going to escalate to any kind of military confrontation
between us. We've not heard from analysts who believe that either. Nancy Soderbergh, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. So, Peter Dutton, is the Chinese doing a classic testing for weaknesses on the part of the U.S., on the part of Japan, on the part of regional players in East Asia, and will they find them at the end of all of this, do you think?
Well, I think that's exactly what's going on. A lot of what China's doing in the region, I think, is testing the the U.S. Rebalance or the U.S. pivot to the region. Referring to your point about Taiwan, I do think this is really about the about Japan and China and the U.S. Japan-China triangle. And what we're seeing, I think, is not only a pushing against Japan as a way of testing China's role and power in the region, but we also see a very small potential wedge issue because I think the Japanese and American interests are not exactly the same in this particular issue over the Senkaku. We, as a government, have said that we don't take sides over the ultimate question of sovereignty. We will defend Japan's administration over those islands. That's what the government statements have been. But the outcome, the ultimate outcome of the sovereignty question, we don't take a side on. So there is a slight wedge issue because it really matters to Japan. And obviously, we have chosen not to take a side on the sovereignty question. So what I think we're seeing is, the very beginning of a wedge issue that China is trying to push into the regional politics and to affect the U.S.-Japan relationship and perhaps give China more room for its own political goals in the region.
Some long historical narratives there, a fascinating triangulation going on in East Asia, and it's all making Vice President Biden's trip to East Asia much more important than we might have thought even 6 months ago. Peter Dutton, professor, director of the China Maritime Studies Institute at the U.S. Naval War College, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And also thanks to Nancy Soderbergh, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Thanks, Nancy.
My pleasure.
So to the tunes of 07 there. That's W Hotel lobby music. Thank you, Jay. The frenzied shopping after Thanksgiving and the pendulum swings the other way for Giving Tuesday. Were you a part of that yesterday? Of course, you give to us all the time.
Hi, this is Patrick from Minneapolis, and we give to charities that we've worked with before or ones that we're interested in. As a newer father of twins, I'm interested in the education and support for new dads. Dads First is our newest recipient.
My criteria for charities that I choose to support always, and especially during the holidays, are those that have the broadest reach and can be doubly efficient, such as buying gifts for friends through UNICEF. My friends get gifts, and I support UNICEF. It's all for the greater good. Everyone wins.
Thanks to Patrick and Judy there in Boston. For Patricia in Hollywood, Florida, it's all about being involved.
Because I'm not in a position to give a lot of money, I focus on small local shelters, programs that provide food and shelter and clothing for local residents.
I'm Robert Morgan from Carrollton, Texas. And being completely candid, whatever crosses my Facebook feed while I'm in a good mood usually finds my donation dollars.
Bob, the impulse giver there in Carrollton, Texas. And this 07 song is called Give It Away. Tell us your approach to giving this holiday season. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Later this hour, we're talking to Peter Singer, bioethics professor at Princeton University. He thinks we need to change the way we think about giving. It's coming up a little later this hour here on The Takeaway. You know, we've always got Frank Sinatra recordings. They're coded away digitally in our collective memory. Not biological, but it's memory.
Thanks for the memory of things I can't forget. Journeys on a jet.
You know, there's this experiment about memory I learned about in high school biology class a long time ago. Flatworms, planaria, trained to be sensitive to light, were then ground up and fed to other flatworms without this sensitivity. And then after ingesting the biological encoding for light sensitivity, they developed the same sensitivity. Wow. Memory encoded and passed on. I wondered if deeply intuitive learned notions could also be passed on, like music, even history itself. Is there some encoded memory tape of what my great-great-great-grandfather saw in the Civil War that I could put on a screen? Well, I was assured by my biology teacher that no, only primitive stuff could be passed on. But a new study from geneticists at the Emory University School of Medicine may demonstrate that learned traits in higher species, not primitive stuff, can be passed on through DNA. Mice trained to be afraid of a smell similar to a cherry blossom produced mouse children and grandchildren who also hated the smell of the cherry blossom. Could a fear, a smell, be transmitted through a sperm and an egg?
This is unprecedented. We had some evidence from other work before that some exposures could be passed to the next generation. But it was never shown in such a specific way that a specific smell can be passed to the next generation on a specific gene that recognizes them.
That's Moshe Ziff, an epigeneticist and professor at McGill University in Montreal, reacting to the study. We wanted to talk about all this with David Schenk. He's the author of the book, The Genius in All of Us. He's talked a lot about epigenetics. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back, John.
So the specific smell idea is unprecedented, but theoretically, we've been headed in this direction for quite a while.
We have. Ever since 1999, when there was an experiment done on the toad flax plant and flower, we discovered that as Lamarck, Monsieur Lamarck told us almost 200 years ago, and we laughed at him for 200 years, it's not just the genes themselves that pass on the information for the traits, but the epigenome, the envelope that the genes are wrapped up in, the DNA is wrapped up in. And what that means, and what we learned in 1999, and now there have been a dozen or more experiments that have confirmed this, is that lifestyle can alter – life experiences can alter the epigenome. You can pass on results of your own life through your epigenome without altering your actual genes, and that can go on to your kids, your grandkids. Who knows how far that can go.
And the epigenome is kind of an engine of genetic material and triggers from the environment so that you pass on the epigenome, and if you encounter some of those same triggers in the environment, boom, you're switched on to the lifestyle. That's at least part of the story.
Absolutely. That's really well put. So what people – if to take a step back, what people need to realize – and they didn't learn this when they were kids in school – but that genes are mostly about gene expression. They're getting turned on and off like more like switches than just kind of, you know, the blueprint of sending information. And now we know for sure that the epigenome is a big part of that. And now we know for sure with today's study and the few recent studies that we can alter our own epigenome and pass that on to our kids and grandkids.
In evolutionary terms, I was fascinated by the remarks of this professor, Moshe Ziff, up at McGill in Montreal. He has this to say about how this mechanism may work in evolutionary terms.
There are periods in evolution where things happen faster than just a natural selection could explain, and mechanisms like this can explain it. Not only that it happens faster, but it happens at a much higher frequency. The Darwinian evolution is based on random changes to genes that happen very infrequently. A mechanism like the mechanism that was shown in this paper happens at a very high frequency.
Can you help me understand what the high frequency, low frequency sort of thing is? How could epigenetics sort of explain speeded up periods of evolutionary change?
Well, so we're used to thinking of evolution as what Darwin told us, this idea that that has to be kind of a random genetic mutation. We need to wait for that mutation, and then subsequently will lead to possibly a different trait, and then survival of the fittest. This is a whole different mechanism. This is you experiencing something in your life before you become a parent, and that's somehow getting imprinted on your epigenome and then translating to your kids and your grandkids. So that's obviously a lot faster in terms of the evolutionary change.
So can I throw an example at you? This could be maybe Neanderthals collectively having the experience of not finding much in the way of fruit and berries in their northern European lifestyle, and so they're conditioned to think about obsessing over sweets when they encounter them. That's the kind of thing that could be stored in an epigenetic sort of way that will be passed on from generation to generation.
It absolutely is. We have studies that show that nutrition is a part of the story here. Nutrition can absolutely affect your epigenome and your epigenetic inheritance.
Now, can you pass along Frank Sinatra lyrics to your children in memory? Or
the no? truth is, we don't know how far this goes. But I can tell you this. This is going to be the century of the epigenome. It's going to change. If last century was the century of genetics, this is going to be the century of epigenome. It's going to affect everything we understand about disease, about intelligence, about talent, about lifestyle, and about evolution.
Is it encodable or decodable in the way that we, you know, specified the human genome? Epigenetically speaking, are these tapes that can be rewound and played back, or is it something fundamentally different?
You know,
Stump the Shank. That's the name of the show, folks.
I think the answer is that, you know, there's mostly we know a lot about what we don't know, but we've opened a door here, and we now know now from confirmation, many, many studies that are confirming the same principle in many different ways.
But we think of the human genome as kind of passive, as something that's sort of set down and stated. The epigenetic is the opposite.
Exactly.
It's dynamic. It's moving. It's constantly interacting with the environment.
Life experience can alter your epigenome, and that can and does get passed on to your progeny.
Well, the genes of intelligence you've obviously passed on to your children, David. But what epigenetically speaking do you think you've passed on as well? Or is that too scary a thought?
I've probably passed on all my anxieties too, and my smell disorders and everything else.
David Shank is the author of the book, The Genius in All of Us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The giving season, we're asking, how do you determine where your charitable donations go? Tallahassee, Florida, one of you says, I give 27% of my annual income, whatever the source of it may have been, and I give based on the amount of the donation actually reaching the intended recipients.
This is Marianne from Athens, Ohio. We are increasingly careful in researching organizations before we donate. We try to be sure that they do not discriminate or exclude anyone from receiving services or goods. We also try to look for organizations such as Direct Relief, where less of the funds go to administration and more to the people who actually are needy and will benefit from these gifts.
Thanks, Mary. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Follow us on Twitter, at The Takeaway. Join the conversation.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Another brain story here. Men are different than women. This is news. Well, the nature versus nurture debate regarding what is innate about being male or female and what is the result of environmental conditioning could possibly get a fresh look because of a new study from the University of Pennsylvania. A team of researchers using an advanced imaging technology has discovered that the basic circuitry of men and women's brains is visibly different. Raghunath Burma, who is an associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Department of Radiology, specializes in biomedical image analysis, joins us now. Raghunath, thanks for being with us.
Hi.
Let's talk about the imaging. What kind of imaging are we talking about here?
This is diffusion imaging, so it actually keeps track of the underlying water diffusion in the brain. So think of traffic system in the brain, so the roads and the traffic. The roads are the white matter pathways in the brain, and the traffic is the functional connectivity on it. So diffusion imaging gets to the underlying white matter pathways in the brain.
How different did you find male and female brains, and how surprised were you by the difference?
Well, very different. They use complementary pathways, it seems, to do tasks. And it was a pleasant surprise. We were trying to study the different pathways between men and women in order to find out how disease progresses differently in men and women. It was a pleasant surprise that diffusion imaging can show these differences so that we could use this later for diagnosis or prognosis.
Now, because of what's called plasticity in the brain, that circuitry is some ways a function of the environment, could these differences be explained by just the fact that males and females are culturated differently, or is this something that comes from birth?
The question you're asking is whether structure mediates function or function mediates structure.
Right.
No, this study doesn't delve into what were the causes for the differences. Hopefully, this is a huge study run by Ruben and Raquel Gore, the neuropsychiatrists at Penn. It's 1,000 people. They also have functional imaging. So hopefully, we should be able to answer something like this in the future. But right now, It is that these people were similar in various respects. I mean, we matched them on various respects. They were also healthy controls, and they seemed to show, they showed all these differences. So no, it is difficult to say what was the reason for the differences, except that they were different.
But we're now in a position to maybe ask that really important question. Does the way in which men and women are raised change the circuitry of their brain, or is there something very, very specific in the beginning that creates this different level of functionality, different level of structure, right?
Yes. The study also has a lot of functional imaging in it, so we should be able to answer this question. Also, this is a population study. So what you see is on a level of 1,000 people, how different men and women are on the gross level. Individual differences which come in are not what we did in the study, but would be a second stage of the study, which means trying to give someone a number which says how overlapping their brain is with respect to a male or a female brain.
Ragini Verma is associate professor in the University of Pennsylvania's Department of Radiology, where she specializes in biomedical image analysis, reporting on a study at Penn, a huge study at Penn, showing different visual structures in the circuitry of male and female brains. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
We'll return to Asia for a moment. In China today, Vice President Joe Biden will have an opportunity to learn what the Chinese think of reports from South Korean intelligence that a major power shift has occurred in North Korea. Dictator Kim Jong-un has reportedly ousted Jong Sung-taek, his uncle and the most experienced person in North Korea, and the one closest to the North Korean military. How significant are these reports? We turn now to Dr. Sun-Yung Lee, who is professor in Korean studies at the Tufts University Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So what do you make of the South Korean assessment that indeed a power struggle has taken place? They're, I suppose, in a position to know, but how much can we really trust what's going on here?
Well, the news of the sacking of North Korea's number two man, the uncle of the current leader, Kim Jong-un, is credible because Jang Song-taek, Jang, has been sacked. He has been purged in the past, at least on two occasions, and has made a comeback. And more to the point, for many years now, even under the former leader, the father of the current North Korean leader, under his reign, Jang Song-taek was considered universally as North Korea's de facto number two man. And in a totalitarian system like North Korea, the number two man often becomes target of political purge.
It comes with the assassination of two other officials, or execution of two other officials, according to the South Korean reports. Is it likely that Kim Jong-un is consolidating a younger set of cadres around him to carry the leadership into a fundamentally new generation and possibly new vision of North Korea?
I think that would be the most reasonable assessment. Kim Jong-un, as you know, is a young man, inexperienced. He's been in power for only 2 years now. And in the meantime, he has shown himself to be quite brash and militaristic. Over the past 2 years, he has conducted two ballistic long-range missile tests and also a nuclear test. And that is a potentially dangerous situation, that you have this person in charge. In terms of his lifestyle, Kim may be the richest man presiding over one of the poorest countries in the world, who is treated like a semi-deity by his people. A young person who feels infallible, who believes himself to be near godlike and omnipotent, with his finger on the nuclear button. That's a strange and dangerous formulation.
The Chinese have described General Zhang as the institution or the face of stability in North Korea, such as it is. If he's out of the picture, and of course he has trade ties with the Chinese as well, do the Chinese have to cultivate some fundamentally different sort of relationship with Kim Jong-un? For instance, are the Chinese capable of supporting his lifestyle and therefore, by implication, capable of yanking his chain if he steps out of line?
I would think the Chinese are at minimum displeased by the latest news because, yes, Chang has been a prime link between the two countries. For instance, last year in August of 2012, Chang visited China and met with all the top officials. It was almost a head of state visit in terms of how the Chinese accorded Chang favors and privileges. So the Chinese must be slightly alarmed by this latest news. And maybe the North Korean leader is sending a signal to the Chinese that I will be defiant toward you, although I go on depending on you for sustenance, for subsidization. Like my father and my grandfather, I will not bow down to the Chinese.
What are the limits there, though? I mean, in the sense that certainly North Korea can be defiant to China, but there would have to be limits as to how defiant it can be. It does appear that China has really no choice but to support North Korea or face even greater instability. So China's really hitched to the Kim Jong-un wagon here for a while.
That's exactly right. China and North Korea over the past 60 years have had always a tense relationship, but it is in China's strategic interest to maintain the status quo in Korea, which is diplo speak for going on to continuing to support the Kim regime. So North Korea is banking on that. And in some ways, China, like the United States, South Korea, and Japan, remain hostage to this very backward, poor, belligerent regime that is the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
A power struggle, a power shift in North Korea. Dr. Sun Yung Lee is professor in Korean studies and an assistant professor at Tufts University's Fletcher School. Thanks so much, Professor.
Thank you.
You know, it's a little like Fashion Week here in New York, although, you know, anyone can play, not just the runway crowd. The department store windows unveil their holiday displays, and the crowds gather, ooing and eyeing at the various themes. What will it be this year? Like so much of the holiday season, the storefront window experience is also migrating online. Decorated Facebook pages and web pages form a window-like experience. People are inclined to decorate for Christmas, whether they're selling anything or not. And as we look at this digital migration of the holidays, we wanted to see how the retro department store front window is responding to technology, and it certainly is. Barney's New York, for instance, is using some 3D mapping and some advanced light projections in their windows. And this year, a high-tech interactive component of the famous Saks Fifth Avenue window has been designed by the Science Project. Jeremy Bergstein is the managing partner and head of strategy for the Tribeca-based digital storytelling and design firm Science Project. Jeremy, welcome.
Hello.
So first of all, before we talk about what you've done over there at Saks, which is pretty fascinating, give me a sense of the kind of buzz of the department store window world. You've had experience over at Barney's. Is this the kind of thing where everybody pitches their idea and somebody gets to do it and there's a sort of a, no, I think we need to go in this direction? Are there, you know, crazy egomaniacs running the department store window world?
I would say there's really true vision and true magic in the creative departments at these brands and these department stores. I mean, they really have got a vision in mind, and it has got to be amazing. It's New York City at the holidays. It does not get any cooler. So,
And Saks and Barney's and Macy's are like different magazines. They're like fundamentally different kind of ideas and visions.
Absolutely. I mean, the stores are laid out differently. The brands that they work with are quite different, and the customers that come and see them. While people are walking around from one to the other, the stores are trying to project a different, a different attitude, a different vision, and a different, you know, a different type of magic.
So what interactive I noticed on your site, you're really something advocate of something called retail theater. You really want people to, you know, see themselves on stage in the whole retail experience. What interactive idea did you pitch to Saks, and how did it get executed in the windows this year?
Well, we've been playing with some great technology around connected devices, the ability to transfer information and objects from, you know, simple mobile phones onto a screen. And I had been invited last year to take a look at the amazing work that Saks had done with the Yeti, the famous Yeti from the cartoons that we all grew up with as kids. And, you know, the Yeti is in the windows. It was really a magical story. And we got the idea of being able to throw snowflakes onto the window or onto the building or into the, you know, into a window. And it also accomplished a few other things. Technology in the past had been a barrier in between stores. It was either you go online or went in the store, and they were having a cannibalistic sort of relationship.
Right.
And now we had the ability to flick a snowflake from your mobile phone, which has been a very personal device, into a window, sort of penetrating that the window and bringing you into the story, into the store, and breaking that barrier. So it's been really exciting, kind of helping to break that barrier in between technology and the store.
So since this is radio, give me a very storyboarded sense of the user experience. If I'm standing there in front of the Saks window, what can I do to flick that snowflake?
So the user will go on their cell phone and they will go to a simple URL, saks.com/snow, and up comes the Yeti. Welcome to the North Pole. You're now in the story. You enter in your first name, your last name, and you choose, are you a boy, girl, or a boy Yeti or a girl Yeti? And then you select whether you're a boy or a girl, and you put in your email, and it generates algorithmically a Yeti name that's derived from a bunch of different, of course, from the Yeti population.
Right, right. And you take it to the window.
You take it to the window, and then you choose one of 30 different snowflakes, amazing, beautiful, artistic snowflakes that Saks had made. And it matches your Yeti name with the snowflake, and you push on the snowflake and flick it. Flicks off the phone, snow falls down on your phone, and then all of a sudden, instantly in the window, your snowflake appears in a 3D world of Yetis. And
everybody standing in front of the window goes, ooh,
yeah,
there I am.
Yeah, it's a real simple, just digital technology trick, but it's a really satisfying experience, which in a lot of ways websites sometimes lack in.
This seems kind of retro for you in the sense of a store window is, you know, very brick and mortar, and you guys do the opposite of that, yet you've done the Gaga display a couple of years ago at Barney's. How do you think – you talked about it a little bit. How do you think the retro piece goes with the sort of futuristic online piece?
Well, I would say, first of all, it's a true honor to work in the stores because this is really where retail – you know, this is really the full expression of retail, especially in a New York City department store. And the idea that we're able to get digital into those stores in an additive way rather than something that's detractive, rather than taking away from the in-store experience, it's additive to the in-store experience and not at odds with it, that the shopper is able to go in and get more information or have a richer experience or have a better emotional connection with the store or the brands. That's really exciting to us, and we don't view it as being retro. We sort of view it as advancing retail slightly.
And, much more to come.
Much more to come.
Much more to come. Jeremy Bergstein is managing partner and head of strategy for the Tribeca-based digital storytelling and design firm Science Project, who is the person behind your ability to flick a snowflake into the window at Saks Fifth Avenue, standing on Fifth Avenue or 50th Street. Jeremy, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John.
Can you hit me off with another one?
Thinking about giving.
Hi, my name is Cheyenne from Panorgil, Pennsylvania, and I choose to give to charities that go beyond providing a safety net to those who promote social justice and use advocacy to give a voice to people who are traditionally underrepresented in the decision-making process.
David in North Miami, Florida writes, I've been helping the Greater Hollywood Philharmonic Orchestra for over a decade. They definitely need some help. Thanks for that. We've seen the arts take big hits this year. I'm sure that donation will help that institution. What's your strategy for giving? Up next, we'll hear from Peter Singer, bioethics professor at Princeton University, who thinks we all need to change how we think about giving. More with the head, less with the heart.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
You know, it's kind of an American thing. Thursday, it's It's a decadent feast where we're supposed to be thankful, Thanksgiving. Then Friday, an even more decadent display of buying and consumption called Black Friday, that orgy of deals and buying that continued through the weekend, launches the Christmas shopping season, topped off with a sort of mini frenzy of buying online. Monday for holiday shoppers who can't stand another mall parking lot. That's Cyber Monday, right? Only then do we have time for Giving Tuesday. That was yesterday. Do we have things in the right order here, morally, rationally? Maybe this little sequence depicts exactly what's wrong with the way we think about charitable giving in the United States. Peter Singer, bioethics professor at Princeton University, has thought a lot about this. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
I'm wondering if it's a bit of a meta comment on a lot of what you've talked and written about, that, you know, the Giving Tuesday comes after everything else, the feast, the buying, the consumption. It's a bit of a, pecking order that maybe underscores what's wrong rather than what's right.
I think the excessive consumption is one of the things that's wrong, and maybe people are expiating that. They realize that they've spent too much on things that they don't really need, and now it's time to do some good. But, you know, I don't want to give the impression that I think we should all be just dressed in sackcloth and, you know, secular saints walking around spending nothing on anything else except doing good. I think you have to be a bit more realistic than that. People are going to want to have fun. But the point is that, you know, most Americans are affluent enough to have fun and still have money to spare for those who are in much greater need than they are.
And again, I think we make the mistake in America, and maybe it's just me, and we've had arguments before in the past, but, you know, thinking about it as a pendulum swinging one way and the other way, as a binary, on the one side there's consumption, on the other side there's charitable giving. I mean, in fact, what you argue is that we need to be more strategic about all of this, that it needs to be incorporated into our lives in a much more integrated way than we experience it typically.
That's right. I think that if we want to think of ourselves as ethical people, and if we're, let's say, comfortably middle class or above in an affluent country like the United States, we ought to be giving to those in much greater need, particularly those in extreme poverty elsewhere in the world, as part of our regular things that we do. It should be something that we do every year that we put aside, or perhaps every month that we take off on our credit card. That should be something that we see as part of our responsibility. That is something that makes us an ethical person, to recognize that we're fortunate and that others are so much less fortunate, and that we can make a big difference to their lives.
When you teach students at Princeton in your course on charitable giving, what assumptions do they come to the class with, and how do you either explore or modify those over the course of teaching?
I think people come with the whole range of assumptions that Americans, and for that matter, the international students at Princeton, come with. And mostly that is that essentially what we're doing in our lives is okay, that most people are generally living good lives, and they probably think that they themselves are doing the right thing, that they're not cheating or stealing or attacking other people, and that that's enough to be an ethical person. And I try to get them to see that given where they are in the world and given where the rest of the world is, that's not enough, that they're in a very privileged position, and that if they want to live ethical lives, there are things that go beyond conventional morality that they ought to be doing.
And in many ways, America's freedom idea and individualism idea teaches a lesson of stay out of other people's way, don't bog them down in any way, and you can be comfortable to be as wealthy and successful as you want. I'm wondering if the ethics that you're talking about really involves a sense of constant giving and sacrifice, a consciousness that you are giving because you have, period, and it doesn't have to be based on any specific outcome.
I don't think the things that you're giving up, some of the consumer goods, which, as we mentioned, people might have bought in the last week or so, I don't think that they are anywhere nearly as important as the sense that you are doing something that helps others, that you're joining with others to try to make the world a better place. So I don't think of that as a sacrifice. And secondly, I'm much more concerned about the results than I am about the fact that you are virtuous. I'm not so really interested in getting people to be more virtuous as people. I'm really more interested in getting people in extreme poverty who don't have enough to eat or can't get basic health care or have to watch their child die from some easily treatable disease like diarrhea or pneumonia. I'm interested in trying to get that situation changed.
So you would object on philosophical grounds, it seems to me, to the United Way approach, where you sort of give with confidence that they're going to work out all the details of the outcomes. You want people more engaged in the specific outcomes when they give. Is that true?
That is true, and that's one of the things we do in our class. We give people choices between different projects, and we have real money. We have donors who've donated enough so that each group of a dozen students, each discussion section, can donate $100 to a charity, and we give them information about different charities. And we found that they are giving to organizations that are helping the global poor. When they look at the facts of the situation, they don't just want to give to some generic thing. They really want to make sure that they get the biggest bang for their buck, and the evidence suggests that you do that by giving to effective charities that are helping the global poor.
Who wouldn't you give to this time of year based on your set of principles?
Well, just for example, if a lot of people give because they say somebody they love died of breast cancer, and so they give to breast cancer research. And I can understand that sort of personal attraction, but 90% of the global burden of diseases, the diseases that kill most of the people or make most of the people sick, actually only get about 10% of the research funding in the world. And that's because the people can't afford new treatments, or their diseases like, as I said, diarrhea or pneumonia, malaria, measles, that we already know how to treat. And so we can, you know, we can treat far more people for the good that money will do if you give it to something like cancer research in general. It can save many more people if it's given to one of these organizations, to organizations that are involved in deworming, for example. Mm-hmm. We have a list of recommended organizations on my website called thelifeyoucansave.org, and we're recommending organizations that are doing things in developing countries to help a range of conditions which can be treated much more cheaply than cancer in America.
Well, it's all called effective altruism. Peter Singer, bioethics professor at Princeton University and author of The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty. Thanks so much.
Thanks. It's been good to be with you.
So holiday giving is just one of the things that's moving online as part of the Christmas experience going digital. If you've got ideas about how your favorite holiday tunes may take a modern spin to reflect our digital Xmas, send us your digital Christmas lyric upgrade for Santa Claus Is Coming to Town. That's the one we're working with. Or you can choose any carol. Here's one we received from Karen Escalona. My staff and I will try to do it justice. Ready, guys? Here we go.
We better watch out. Better not cry. An algorithm is telling us why Santa's drones are coming to town. He's made a fresh list from face reading stats, watched our YouTubes of harming our cats. Emoticons are showing a frown. He sees us when we're sleeping.
Yikes.
He knows when we're awake.
Oh no.
He's tracked our social media to update every day.
Every day.
So we better watch out. Block our webcams, scrub the trash bins, anything that we can. Santa's drones are coming to town.
Thanks for the opportunity to humiliate ourselves, Karen. Got anything else to share? Give us your take by calling 8778-MY-TAKE. And if you want to catch up on that conversation, listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.